I came back down from the housetop and went to my house. Then an old, old lady came to me and asked me all kinds of questions.
I was shooting birds, surrounded by sunflowers as big as evergreen trees. But then these big men came and fought for the birds, taking them all.
And she had a book and a pencil.
I was in Europe touring a bombed-out city, and the city must have been Paris because some of the buildings I had seen in Life magazine.
And she wrote down everything I said.
All this fighting I dreamed.
I looked at her and started to laugh at her and said, "Give me your book and let me read what you wrote down."
I noticed the city was somehow now located in a valley.
I looked at this woman close, and it was my mother.
And the houses were tumbling down, down, down.
Imagine finding a buried archive from more than a half century ago that contained the inner life of the people of a lost civilization, their thoughts, their desires, their dreams, thoughts collected by an eccentric psychologist, Bert Kaplan, and his team. Back in the 1950s, Kaplan wanted to study human dreams in a systematic way. He created a catalog of millions and millions of note cards filled with text, documenting answers to Rorschach tests, descriptions of dreams and life histories, mostly from Native American and non-European participants. Harvard professor Rebecca Lemoff came across Kaplan's box in the Library of Congress. It had sat unopened for 50 years like a spooky accidental time capsule. Lemoff is a professor of the history of science at Harvard University and wrote the book A Database of Dreams about Kaplan's work and the deeper impulse to record everything about humanity in a single database.
I was studying the history of this very ambitious filing cabinet that was started at Yale in the 1930s, and it was meant to contain all essential data on all people in the world. What I noticed in the footnotes is that there was a mention of an even more ambitious but elusive database where they had tried to gather everything that had been left out of this seemingly total filing cabinet, and that was what I came to call the database of dreams. It was meant to collect all the subjective elements of human experience that couldn't be easily pigeonholed.
And, I mean, the first category isn't easy to pigeonhole itself. What kinds of things were they collecting in the first instance, and then how did they make the leap to weird stuff that we have no category for?
Right. The first one interested me because they were very systematic about trying to collect data or information about every human and also non-human activity that took place in a culture. So they were systematic and ranging from even flora and fauna to rituals of death. But they were mostly shared cultural information, and they aspired to gather all the data of 10% of societies that had ever existed. And they, by the mid-1960s, they had over 65 million index cards.
And what did they think they would have at the end of all of this?
What they expressed was that they wanted a kind of at your fingertips, a machine that would provide people's dreams at the touch of a button.
And why do you think this was kept?
It was never thrown away because it suddenly just was so irrelevant. And it lapsed into a state of what I call suspended animation, where it was neither destroyed nor preserved, but sort of just lapsed.
When you say it became irrelevant, how so? Is it a format, or was it more deeply found to be irrelevant?
Well, for one thing, the format, you know, lost out in the great sort of the Betamax versus right. VCR of its day. So microcard lost out. But more deeply, the paradigm of social science that they were operating under came to seem problematic by the 60s with the civil rights movement, with decolonization. So because most of the data they actually did collect came from American Indians, and it was sort of a global reach of what they called non-literate people, which wasn't actually always true. But in many ways, they were imagining and watching people as they were contacted by the dominant society and were changed by it. So their data reflected this kind of journey or acculturation. But later that paradigm itself came under attack. For example, on an island that was occupied by the U.S. Navy, some anthropologists would come along and take the Rorschach test of everyone on the island.
Ink blots, right.
Ink blots, exactly. And
what must they have thought?
Yeah, and sometimes that intrudes into the record. So there'll be a question by the person who's taking the test, like, what good does this do my people? Or sometimes they had never even seen a two-dimensional picture before, much less an ink blot, which was supposed to be universal. So in many ways, the kind of cracks in their research design revealed themselves.
Thinking about this project now in light of the big data and the ways in which we have access to, on a huge scale, data about people, How do you compare them?
Yeah, that's really what this project was about for me, was to try to engage in that kind of comparison, because I think it's often missing from the conversation about big data. And a kind of bumper sticker phrase I like to use comes from the 1973 sci-fi thriller Soylent Green, which is...
Yes, I remember.
I adapt it to say, instead of Soylent Green is people, big data is people. And I think the way it's often described is as if it was this kind of cold, hard, inhumane data, when in fact it's our most intimate actions and our baby photos being massively uploaded. I think we're all dealing today with the kind of crisis that Kaplan and his team were pioneers of.
You know, we talk a lot about data for the election. And, you know, the way in which people voted in Rhode Island for the Republican candidates is something of huge import today, but it's completely meaningless and worthless and useless tomorrow. But 100 years from today, 200 years from today, 1,000 years from today, if you were to stumble upon a box that contained, you know, all the conversations of people at Best Buy, you know, ordinary, irrelevant moments of human life, you would think you had stumbled on something so unbelievably valuable in terms of its insight into the people who lived then.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's a good reminder. That's the kind of thing that, exactly the kind of thing that became interesting. There is an example of a sociologist in 1947 who was part of this project. He formed what he called the Oskaloosa Day Station in Kansas, where he studied everyday life. And he recorded things like a boy putting on his socks at 7:01 in the morning in October. And that's preserved. When you pull the data up again, it does look like a lost literary treasure in a way that you wouldn't otherwise have been able to access, except that they were saved by this kind of quixotic process.
Did you just sit and search through it for hours and just look at random stuff?
I did, and I was constantly stumbling upon the most unlikely, beautiful things that I never would have come across otherwise. There was one of that was preserved of a Navajo man who had just come back from World War II, and he'd come back to his village. And he was remembering being sent abroad. He had been sent to Little Stockton in England, where he would bicycle to work every day and have tea. And then he described, you know, when the war was over, they flew him over concentration camps, and he was in the street when people were jitterbugging naked. And it's a point of view that otherwise is eclipsed. That's sort of just the dailiness of even the things we now file under major world events.
It also reminds us that, you know, the history that we get, the story that we're told about what happens is so one channel. And reality is infinite channels at infinite time, you know, in infinite dimensions.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it.
Which certainly makes it hard to write a grant, I suppose.
For them or for me.
Rebecca Lemoff, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Lemoff is a professor of the history of science at Harvard University, author of Database of Dreams. To see pictures of some of Kaplan's note cards, you can head to thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.